Well, good evening, all. Well, isn't it wonderful to have a little bit more rain? You know, if you thank God for the rain, maybe He'll send more. How are you doing on your daily Bible reading? All of you who are current or reasonably current within a day or so, oh, that is just marvelous. And I appreciate the fact that you are wading through the Bible in a year's time. If you're current or reasonably current, we've gone through Acts chapter 17. But I want you to go back to Acts chapter 17 with me this evening. We're going to spend all of our time in the second half of this chapter. We're going to start in verse 16 and read down through the end of the chapter. Acts chapter 17 has to do with Paul's second missionary journey, and boy, what a lousy trip it has been so far. Oh, it started out badly, I mean, from the very beginning of this trip. Started out with a fight with Barnabas. That was his great good helper that went with him on the first missionary journey, and they never even got out of the blocks on the second one before they've already had a fight and split up, and they've gone their separate ways. Barnabas wanted to take Mark. Paul thought that was a lousy idea, so Paul and Silas went one way, and Barnabas and Mark went another way entirely. Started out with a fight and kind of deteriorated from there. They marched up through the region of Turkey. Wanted to preach in Asia. The Holy Spirit wouldn't let him do that. Instead, saw this vision of a man in Macedonia saying, "Come over and help us." So they left Turkey, went across the straits there, wound up a little town called Neapolis, which is the seaport for Philippi. They went on into Philippi, had some success there, also got beaten, thrown into prison. That's not a great recommendation for a mission trip. Left Philippi. Went down the road to Thessalonica, spent 3 weeks preaching in the synagogue there, got run out of Thessalonica by the Jews, went to Berea. They weren't even satisfied to run him out of Thessalonica. They followed him to Berea and ran him out of Berea, and now he's down in Athens. This is not promising. The whole trip is just not promising. I want you to imagine how you would feel if you were sent on a mission trip, if the elders came to you and said, "Okay, here's what we want you to do. We want you to go to New York City and preach to the elite celebrities there, okay? Go get them!" And they just kind of give you a push in that direction. It's not terribly promising. But Paul is going to take a crack at this. He's a brilliant communicator. And when he starts talking to the elites there in Athens, he's there in the marketplace. It's at a place called the Areopagus, really. This is where the philosophers would gather and talk about ideas and try to advance their own ideas here. So Paul arrives there, and he's going to talk to them about Jesus. And he starts by talking about what they all have in common. Hey, that's a pretty good strategy when you stop to think about it. We'll talk about what we all have in common. He's going to tell them about Jesus. They don't know about Jesus, but he's going to start with what they all have in common. We're going to watch this process pretty closely, and here's why. We want to talk to people about Jesus. We want to talk to people about their soul, and we want to talk to them about the gospel, and we don't want to be confrontational. We don't want to have some kind of a fight with them. We don't want to do high-pressure, hard-sell tactics or anything like this. We just wanted to talk about Jesus. And Paul gives us a great strategy for doing that, because it's very non-confrontational. He just advances some ideas to them. It seems like they don't really want to hear him, but he is able to start with what they have in common and move on from there. What if we did this? What if we adopted the same strategy? Just start with what we have in common and start talking to people about Jesus. Let's go ahead and read the whole thing. We're going to read it a piece at a time, start in Acts chapter 17, verse 16, and just talk about what we have in common. Because from the very beginning, see, everybody has some things in common. We all do some things about the same way. We have some common ground to start with. So let's start with Acts chapter 17, beginning in verse 16, and realize that from the very beginning, everybody has a way of life that they think makes sense. Start with me in verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them, his helpers, Timothy and Silas, while he's waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. Yeah, no kidding. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remark he seems to be advocating foreign gods. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? You're bringing some strange ideas to our ears. We want to know what they mean." All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. There's Luke's little editorial comment there, so you'll understand why this was so terribly important to these people. It's almost like they had this gossip society about new ideas. They just didn't talk about whatever new ideas came in. So, everybody has a way of life, and that way of life makes sense to them. This made perfect sense to these philosophers who are gathered there. There are two basic groups here, the Stoics and the Epicureans. And I know this doesn't thrill you too much to hear about these guys, but I want you to just listen and see that they have an awful lot in common with people we live around too. Stoics were people who said that the key to happiness is keeping yourself in control. So you don't ever want to let your emotions run away with you. You want to be governed by logic. You remember Spock on the old Star Trek things? You know, it's pure logic and totally unemotional. He was like the picture book Stoic, okay? So the Stoics never wanted to get excited about anything, and they were very, very big on ethics, right and wrong and how you should live. They wrote whole long books, and we have some of those books on ethics, about how to deal with family matters and how to deal with work relationships, things like that. The other big group that was available was the Epicureans, and they've gotten a bad rap over the years. We kind of look at Epicureans as a bunch of drunks, hedonists that would just do anything that they wanted to do. As long as it made them happy, they'd go ahead and do that. That really is not who they were. They thought that the key to happiness was enjoying life. And so you can go ahead and eat a fresh pear off of a tree, that's fine, but enjoy the thing. You know, I mean, just think about what you're doing and taste the thing and enjoy it. So whatever the experience is, you're supposed to be there and enjoy it. And the Epicureans also had a lot to say about ethics, about right and wrong and how to live. And by the time of Jesus and by the time that Paul shows up in Athens, these are the two big parties, if you will, among the philosophers. There are the Stoics who say you got to keep yourself in control all the time, and there were the Epicureans who said, no, you just have to enjoy what you're doing. Don't do it thoughtlessly. Actually enjoy what you're doing. The point is that both of them were very big on ethics. They were very big on right and wrong and how to live in society and what your duties were to the country and so on. They talked a lot about right and wrong. And there are a lot of people out here in our world who have a way of life. You know that. They may not have God in their lives, but they have a way of life. They have a way of coping with life. They have a way of thinking about who they are and what they do. They have an approach to ethics. There's right and there's wrong in their world, and usually they can be pretty strict about what they think is right and what they think is wrong. They have this basic approach to life that seems to make sense to them. I mean, it's doing what they need done. They've got a roof over their heads and food to eat and clothes to wear. They're educating and raising their children properly. At least they think they're doing that properly. And for the most part, life seems to be working for them. They assume it's working anyway. And one thing about it is they cannot imagine that there would ever be a better answer. It would never come to their minds to think, wait a minute, maybe there's a better way to do this stuff. They've got a way of life that seems to make sense to them. But without God, it leaves out the whole side of spiritual health. They never think about spiritual health. It doesn't even really come into their consciousness. We are amphibious creatures. We are physical and spiritual creatures at the same time. And I know I've said that over and over and over to you, but it's true. And we do a pretty good job of taking care of the physical side of us. You know, we go to the doctor when we're hurt or sick, or we watch what we eat, things like that. We do a pretty good job of taking care of the physical side of us. The spiritual side can be completely ignored. And people do. They just completely ignore the spiritual side of their lives. But there's a whole half of their existence, and it's the permanent part that they're ignoring. Without God, we're ignoring our spiritual health, and without God, we have no firm place to stand in this world. You can talk about right and wrong all you want to, and you know this. You can talk about right and wrong all you want to, but if you don't have a firm place to stand and say, ultimately, it is the Lord's will, we do this because it is the Lord's will, then everything is just sand, and it just shifts with you, and right becomes wrong, and wrong becomes right, and people love to throw out hypothetical situations that make the right thing the wrong thing to do. But ultimately, without God, life becomes impossible. See, usually spiritual problems surface late in life. They usually don't pop up early. They can sometimes, but usually they surface late in life when people say, I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened. My children are a mess. Two or three of them are in jail, or they're in the hospital, or they're in treatment for something. I've got grandkids who are in trouble with the law all the time. I don't know what happened here. I tried to raise them right. Well, the problem was they never had any spiritual health. So late in life, the person's able to look around and say, something dreadfully wrong has happened. I don't know what it is, but something terribly wrong has happened. I'm not the person I'm supposed to be. My family, they're not the people they're supposed to be. Something's gone bad here. Everybody has a way of life, and everybody wants a way of life that works. But without God, it's impossible. There's no way of life that's going to work without God. Now, we start with common ground. We say, look, you've got a way of life. I've got a way of life. Everybody has a way of living, but without God, ultimately, it's impossible. There's something else that Paul does with it. Start back with me in Acts 17. Look at verse 22. We're going to read down through verse 28, because one of the things Paul points out is everybody has an origin and a heritage in God. Everybody does. Well, you know, no matter what you think about God, you have an origin and some kind of heritage in God. Look at this. Start in verse 22. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious." Some versions say very superstitious, but the actual meaning of that is these guys are personally pious. They're trying to honor the gods as they understand this. We think of superstitious as, you know, very, I don't know, worried about black magic and things like that, magic spells and bad luck and fortune. That's not how it was understood to these people. Superstition was a good thing. They thought that was, you know, personally very pious. "I see that in every way you are very religious," he says, "for as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.'" You know, just in case we've left one out, we want to do some kind of service here and make him feel good too. "Now what you worship is something unknown. I'm going to proclaim to you the God," count them, one, "the God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by hands. And he's not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. From one man he made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the times set for them and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring." So Paul says, look, we all have this origin in God, and we all have this heritage from God. And these people did have some knowledge of God. They had some knowledge that they had heard from the Jews, certainly, but also there were a lot of voices by this time who had been talking about one God and thinking that all these idols, this can't possibly be right. There can only be one God. 400 years and more before Paul got there, Plato was talking about one God. So they were already, some of them were already thinking about this and thinking in that way. And then Paul shifts his attention to where people should live. Where should the Greeks live and where should the Egyptians live? There was a hot topic and all the philosophers were talking about it. Why do the Egyptians live in Egypt and they don't say live in Libya or, you know, live in Palestine? Why do people live where they live? He says it's because God put them there. So Paul was giving them an answer to the real hot potato there. And then finally he quotes one of their own poets. We are his offspring. That's a quotation from a poet named Aratus in a work called Phenomena in Part 5. If you really want to go look that up, you can do that because we still have that work and that's why we know where it came from. These people had an origin and they had a heritage in God, whether they accepted it or not. A lot of our friends have an origin and a heritage in God too. When we start talking about people who don't ever go to church, we talk about the unchurched. People who have absolutely zero contact with a church of some kind are very rare. I mean, once in a while you'll come in contact with them, but people who have zero contact are very rare. Most people have some kind of experience with church. When they were children, they went to vacation Bible school, or a grandmother or grandfather took them, or a neighbor took them. You know, they have some kind of contact. They've heard something about the Lord at some point. Most have some kind of background and some kind of respect for church. They have some kind of respect for God. And contrary to a lot of opinions, they have some knowledge. They know some things. They've heard the word baptism. They know that there's something important about that. They know about communion, and they have some respect for the word. They're not just completely ignorant. They know some things, and so we can talk to them about some of these concepts. And maybe they don't know it accurately, but they know something, and we can talk to them about this. It's part of our common heritage here. Let's go ahead and honor their heritage. Let's go ahead and just adopt that, whatever their background is. Now, you know that I didn't grow up in the church, and I honor my background. I can look back now and see there were influences that were felt in my life when I was a very small child, and they were not influences from the Lord's church. They were influences from other religious groups. But they taught me some things. They taught me some things about Jesus. They taught me some things about the Bible. They taught me some things about God. They taught me about respect. They just taught me about respect for God. Curiously enough, one of the men who may have had, as I look back on it, may have had the most influence in my life to lead me to become a preacher was a Baptist preacher. And I cannot remember a single thing that he preached that I think is any good at all. I can remember some things that he said, and as I think about it, I think that's not very good. You know, that's just not very good. But truly, folks, he was one of the best men. He was one of the nicest men, and I just saw him as a truly good man. And that just shaped my thinking about what a preacher should be. And what a person seriously interested in God should be. We look back in our lives, we have a lot of these influences. These other people do too. Let's borrow that. Let's honor that. Those people have helped them move this far. We want to take them the rest of the way and talk. We can talk then about any kind of differences that we might have, but let's help them move closer to the Lord. We don't have to repudiate everything that's in their past. All those things may have helped to draw them closer. We have that in common. See, there's a common ground there. We have an origin and a heritage in God. Paul was able to use that. These people in Athens, they are out there. I mean, they know very, very little about God, but they know something, and Paul is willing to honor that and use that to help them know the only living God and His Son, Jesus, who died for them. We can use this common religious background that we have just talk about Jesus. Let's go ahead and look at another idea here. Everybody has a future judgment by God. And that takes us to verse 29 to 31 here. Everybody needs to realize there's a future judgment by God. Therefore, in verse 29, it says, therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance. But now He commands all people everywhere to repent, for He has set a day when He'll judge the world with justice by the man He has appointed. He's given proof of this to all men by raising Him from the dead. There's a future judgment out there. And this was kind of an odd idea to some of these people. They really didn't think about life after death. And if they did think that life continued after death, they thought of it like Homer had it. Well, it's just a shadowy, ghostly kind of existence. You're not having a good day ever. It's just, there's not much of a life after death to speak of. Most of them thought that when you're dead, that's it. It's just over. It's like blowing out a match. You know, the flame is gone and it's not coming back. The whole idea of resurrection was a brand new idea to them, and that's why they're a little uncomfortable with that. And at first they think Paul's even talking about some strange deity named resurrection. He's proclaiming resurrection out here, and we don't understand that. There are a lot of people in the world today for whom the idea of resurrection is a very attractive idea, and the idea of a future judgment is a very attractive idea. Yeah, they want an accounting. They ultimately they want somebody to be held responsible for what they've done. That's why we've got Saddam Hussein on trial. He needs to be held accountable for what he's done. Slobodan Milosevic died this past week of a heart attack, and I think a lot of people think he has escaped justice now. And there needs to be an accounting. 200,000 people in Bosnia, Croatia, killed at his orders. 200,000 people dead at his hand. Has he escaped justice? A lot of people want to know for sure that there's an accounting. He has not escaped justice. He's going to have to meet God, and there will be an accounting for that. And a lot of people truly want to know about sin and righteousness and judgment to come. And they don't want us to pull punches. They want us to talk about the truth, that there's right and there's wrong. You can't do what's wrong and expect to be judged to be right. We can work with this. You can talk to people and ask them, do you think Milosevic escaped justice just because he died? You think that wipes the slate clean? You think there's no accounting? Listen to what they say. They'll have interesting insights there. They'll have some things to say about judgment. But, of course, whatever they say about judgment applies to all of us because we'll all meet the Lord in judgment. The judgment waits for us all. And as I said this morning, it's going to be fair. So the big question is, are we ready? Are we going to be ready to meet God in judgment? Ask somebody that sometime. You know, if you get to talking about judgment and people like Milosevic who die before they're brought to justice and made to answer for their crimes, do they just escape? And if they don't escape, what about us? Are we going to escape? We have this in common, that we're all going to face God in judgment. And just working from common ground, we can talk to them about the Lord and grace and His plan for their lives. There's one more thing we all have in common, and that's at the end of the chapter. See, we all have an opportunity. Let's start reading verse 32 and just wind this up. When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered. And you can see that happening, right? Because they don't believe it's going to happen. What a nutty idea, resurrection from the dead. They haven't heard anything like that before. When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said, "We want to hear you again on this subject." At that, Paul left the council. A few men became followers of Paul and believed. Among them was Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus, also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. We all have an opportunity. Look at the responses that take place here. Some of them sneer. "Oh, you gotta be kidding me. Resurrection from the dead. Oh, come on. Cemeteries are full. They're not walking out, you know. There's no such thing as resurrection." And they didn't want to hear any more. Some people were curious. They thought, "I don't know, he says some things that are kind of interesting. We need to investigate this a little bit more. Let's hear some more on this subject." So they're interested, and they're gonna listen to what Paul has to say and see where this goes from here. They're not totally convinced, but they're interested. And then there are some who believed. And it's really interesting to me, the ones that Luke identifies for us. First of all, there's Dionysius. Oh, he's a member of the Areopagus. He's one of these upper crust elites that Paul's been talking to. Hey, he believes. Just goes to show he had good sense after all, right? But you know, the very next one that Luke mentions is a woman named Damaris. There were no women who were members of the Areopagus. And it's fascinating to me that Luke identifies this woman and names her. Obviously, she became important in the church there in Athens. And then Luke just throws in, yeah, there were some others too. We don't bother to get their names. There were some others who believed. That's pretty much the range of responses we'll get as we talk to people about Jesus. We can start with the common ground that we have, but as we talk to them, some people are not going to want to hear anymore. They're not going to be very interested in hearing what we have to say. Some may be interested but not willing to commit. Others will believe. Everybody has this opportunity. This is a chance for salvation for them. Everybody has this opportunity to hear the gospel and obey. And the wonderful thing about it is the gospel message of Jesus does not depend on your status. It doesn't depend on you being a member of the upper crust elite. It doesn't depend on your status. It doesn't depend on your educational level. It doesn't depend on your economic level. It doesn't depend on your heritage or ethnic background. It doesn't depend on any of that. Because the gospel is available for every single person. And the reality is, folks, some people will obey and some will not. You can go ahead, you can start with a common ground and you can tell them about Jesus, and some will obey and some will not. You can work with this. You can listen, just watch what Paul has done here, and you can work with this to start from common ground and tell someone about Jesus. What we all have in common. We have a way of life. We have a way of life, and things seem to be working, and it would never occur to us to ask if there's a better way. But there is. There's a better way with Christ. Everybody has an origin and a heritage in God, and we can work with the things that they know about Jesus and help them to know Him better. Everybody has a future judgment by God. And everybody has an opportunity to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, we're not confronting them or being very obnoxious with them, trying hard sell tactics or anything else, just having a spiritual discussion. We're just talking to them about Jesus, putting in a good word for the Lord, if you will, and helping them to recognize there's a better way. There's a better way to live out there. Paul gives a wonderful example here, just starting with a common story. We have similar interests, we have similar backgrounds, we have similar experiences, and the gospel message is for every single human being. And we can start with what we have in common and tell people about Jesus, because without Jesus Christ, the people we live among will die in their sins and go into an eternity in hell, separated from God forever and ever and ever. Hell is not a myth. It's a reality, and it's all too common a story. But we can help them tell a better story if we'll help them know Jesus. Just by taking what we have in common and then helping them to see that there's a better way. I don't know what your status is. We're going to sing an invitation song this evening and give you an opportunity to respond to Jesus' invitation. If you've kind of known these things, you know some things about Jesus, but you've never committed yourself to Him in baptism, you never obeyed the gospel, you need to do that. Right? You need, because of your belief in Jesus, because you're willing to repent of sin and confess His name before men, you need to be immersed in water for the forgiveness of your sins and raised to a new life with Him. There is a better way to live. If you're a Christian, though, and you've made the covenant with Christ in the past, but you haven't lived with Him and haven't lived for Him, and frankly, your life is not working well, that's why. You need to live with Him and live for Him, for His principles to come alive in your life. It's all too common a story that we start well and then fade. But the wonderful thing about the grace of God is His arms are always open to welcome us home. If you need to respond publicly to the invitation of Jesus Christ, we urge you to do it right now while we stand together and sing the song.